Private 14216 H.E. Welch was serving with the 6th Battalion of the Northamptonshire Regiment. And for several months, they'd been preparing for the big push as they knew it. After the war, in 1975, decades after it happened, he wrote that prior to going over the top on July the 1st, every member of the 6th Battalion was presented with a surprise luxury in the shape of a hard-boiled egg from Colonel Ripley. In the weeks before going over the top, on the first day of the Battle of the Somme, as it became known, the men of the 6th North Ants were billeted in the village of Morlancourt, and many of them spent pleasant hours in the ruined church that had been refitted and knocked into shape by their own padre, the Reverend E.A. Bennett. There was a captain serving with the North Ants, E.F. Stokes. He said on around the 13th of June, so a couple of weeks before the advance, the 18th Division Commander, General Sir Ivor Max, called a meeting for all officers in his division. But Stokes said that the meeting consisted of the most depressing talk by the General, who quite blandly told the listeners, "Many of you will be killed." The Sunday following his talk, the ruined church in Molencourt was crowded with worshippers. And another officer, a Lieutenant Trainer, said, "Our brigade, in fact, the whole of our division, were completely successful in taking all of our objectives. For the rest of that week, we sat in the German trenches, watching the failure of the rest of the attack to hold or even reach any part of the German trench system." So welcome to another episode of the podcast that I, Terry Wenham, called Tales from the Battlefields. And last year, I began a series of podcasts following the story of one of those POWs battalions that was formed at the beginning of the war in August of 1914, the 6th Battalion of the Northamptonshire Regiment. I chose them for lots of different reasons, really, knowing that we would follow their path through all of the major battles in 1916, 17 and 1918. And also because Northampton is my hometown, and many of the men that we quote throughout their story lived in the terraced houses just a few hundred yards from where I'm sitting now. It's their story that I like to tell, as this week we commemorate the 1st of July 1916, the 110th anniversary of that momentous battle, the 1st of July being the worst day in the history of the British Army. We focus on the 6th Northamptonshires and their attack in the southern part of the battlefield, between the villages of Mametz and Montauban. This was where the 18th Division, and in particular the 54th Brigade, did indeed achieve all of their objectives. But of course there's always casualties, heavy casualties. But believe me, succeed they did. And their success, as we shall see, was noted at the highest possible levels of British society. But as usual, we're not necessarily going to look at what happened that day through the eyes of the history books, but rather through the eyes of the men that were there. What was it actually like to take part in that infamous first day? Let's find out, shall we? Before we do that, I always like to give a summary, really, of what they were trying to achieve, what was the plan, and what actually happened on that day. And the best summary I could find came from Jonathan Porter's superb book, 0 Hour Z Day. I think it's one of two volumes that he's written, really drilling down into the operations of every single battalion that went into action on that day. And towards the end of his book, Jonathan superbly describes what happened to the men from Northampton. Now, if you listen to the previous episode, you'll know that the battalion was commanded by a 52-year-old man called George Ripley. And whilst they were at the forefront of the attack, their main duty was to support the other battalions from their brigade that had gone in. Some of the units were tasked with consolidation and carrying forward stores and to resupply the brigade and the other battalions. They were to, as part of the consolidation, set up machine gun posts ready for any potential German counterattack, and two supporting companies acted as mopper-uppers. We'll see how that worked in reality a bit later. They were then to construct 6 strong points, also to deal with any German counterattack. And the night before the attack, the battalion moved forward from Bronfay Farm at 11:30 p.m. and made their way up to the assembly trenches. As dawn broke, the carrion parties moved to their respective stores dumps, which was positioned between 2 assembly trenches. Each of these dumps contained vital supplies which would be required by the brigade when they captured their final objective. Stores and equipment from these dumps would be carried forward as soon as possible. And within each of these dumps, there were 2,500 Mills grenades, 390 rifle grenades, 100 boxes of .303 ammunitions, 40 other boxes of bullets to be used by the Lewis machine gunners, 250 petrol tins of water, 560 Stokes mortar bombs, 2,000 iron rations for the men, and barbed wire to also prevent German counterattacks. Now, the route up to the assembly trenches was not easy because there was a thick morning mist. By 0 hour, though, the battalion was in position. They wouldn't go over the top until 8 o'clock a.m., so they watched and listened to the battle raging to their front and on their flanks. And the relentless racket of continuous explosions and small arms fire must have unnerved even the most enthusiastic and experienced soldiers. Slowly, the minutes ticked away. Ripley, the commanding officer, made one last call to Brigade HQ. All was well. The lead battalions were keeping to schedule, and men could be seen in Pommiers Trench, their first objective. Ripley conveyed the situation to those around him. The message was soon shouted down to the left and right, and runners were soon dispatched with a message for Captain Schreiner. They were told to move forward as planned. And at 8 a.m. precisely, the battalion filed out in lines of half platoons, with the 2 front companies in 2 waves and D Company forming the 3rd wave. The battalion advanced across the open ground, across all 4 assembly trenches, through No Man's Land and to the German second line. The German counter-barrage had now been falling for some time over the British assembly trenches. It was not severe, but was described by the battalion as heavy. It posed a real threat. But then, even before the first wave had reached the 4th assembly trench, several German shrapnel shells burst high in the air above the men moving forward, and these dreadful lead balls rained down at lethal velocity, pelting the ground with a thud. Several men crumpled and fell. Officers and NCOs screamed commands, "Don't bunch! Slow down on the right!" The battalion advanced as if they were on parade. And Ripley, in a post-operational report, said they continued to move forward with admirable coolness, A Company even checking in No Man's Land to correct their direction. So as the lead battalions ahead of them departed Pommiers Trench onto their next objective, the Northamptonshires took up their vacated positions. But don't forget, their job was to mop up. The leading platoons had moved on, leaving Germans still hiding in those deep dugouts beneath their trenches. They had to be cleared, otherwise they would be firing from the rear. This was a crucial part of the job. In other parts of the battlefield, so many battalions, divisions and brigades hadn't even got this far. So within Pommiers Trench, there was a redoubt. And here there was a brutal fight at close quarters, including many hand-to-hand encounters. And there was a Private Frederick Russell. He was one of the bombers. He was one of the 3 men that were charged in this area as a mopper-upper. And as he turned a trench corner, he noticed a large Hessian cloth covering the entrance to a shelter. Slowly he approached, and as he did so, the fighting was going on all around him in the trenches. Grenades were detonating in the open with a loud crack, or in the depths of underground work with a muffled thud. Commanders' orders and shouts for surrender or mercy could be heard in both English and German languages. Russell was covered by 2 of his comrades, and he approached the entrance. Standing to one side of the Hessian cloth, he could hear German voices below ground, so he lifted out a Mills bomb, holding it tightly in his right hand, the fly-off lever securely running down his palm. He withdrew the pin with his left hand first finger. He cautiously pulled the Hessian to one side and flung the grenade towards those voices. As the Mills bomb left his palm, he heard the lever under the force of the spring make a cling noise as it spun away. Next, the bomb landed near the bottom stairs with a thud, rolling and falling a few more steps. The Germans below were now in a state of panic. What followed then was an almighty boom as the Hessian screen fluttered, smoke and dust billowing out of the entrance. There was a few seconds of utter silence, followed by shrieks of absolute terror. Russell had already got a second Mills bomb ready. He extracted the pin and immediately tossed the bomb into the smoke. A few seconds later, a second loud detonation shook the dugout entrance. As the smoke and dust settled, Russell descended the wooden staircase into the dark, holding a third grenade. At the bottom of the stairs, he gingerly peered around the corner, where he could just make out the palms of white hands held out in front of petrified faces. Several pleaded for mercy. Russell beckoned the now prisoners up the stairs. 19 Germans filed out of their underground shelter, and for his gallantry that day, Frederick J. Russell was decorated with the Distinguished Conduct Medal. The fighting continued in and around Pommier's Trench. The artillery kept up its work, causing heavy casualties to the Northants boys. But under the leadership of Captain Schreiner, who'd been seriously wounded earlier but had stayed at his post, they managed to consolidate the position, and for his leadership he was awarded a military cross. By 10:15 a.m, all the strong points on the objective had been occupied and had been prepared for defence. The battalion had completed all of its tasks. The casualties amounted to Captain Frank Neville, Captain Oliver Schreiner, Lieutenant George Shankster, and Second Lieutenant Noel Hamilton wounded. It was reported at the time that 29 other ranks had been killed, wounded 123, and 4 men were missing. The Commonwealth War Graves Commission website tells us that indeed 34 men died that day from the battalion. But as the battle had moved forward, they were able to clear no man's land and the trenches of those men that had been killed, and they were buried in Danzig Alley Cemetery, very close to Pommier Redoubt, Pommier's Trench, where they died. There are in fact 29 of the 34 that died buried in that concentration cemetery. But we often think about the dead. What about the wounded? Here we've got over 130 officers and other ranks that have been wounded, either across no man's land in their own assembly trenches or when they got into the German positions. What happened to them? Well, we've talked about before the chain of evacuation through advanced dressing stations and casualty clearing stations, base hospitals and back to the UK. And I've often wondered what it must have been like when the men received probably the first attention by a doctor carrying out triage. Well, I found an account here that was written by a man called S.W. Weaver, and he describes what it was like. He says, "It's in a cottage at the edge of the village and a huge red cross is painted on the roof. A flag flies outside. The front room is used as an operating theatre. Ambulances arrive and unloading whilst I was there. Casualties were carried in and operated on at once by surgeons with sleeves rolled up and blood spattered on up to their elbows. We find out that they are to go out and bury the dead. The general has been round and is raving about it not having been done before. We divide up into small parties, each under an NCO, and go off to find the bodies. Not very difficult, and then we can bury them before breakfast. We are first warned to be careful, as there are rumours that Fritz has tied egg bombs to his bodies, thus injuring anyone who tries to move them. We go off and pass in the field ambulance, find a big working party digging a very large pit on a village green just opposite the dressing station. Following the trench through a wood, part of an estate, we come across the first German bodies, nearly all bayoneted. One man is still pinned to the post of a dugout by a bayonet, still transfixing him, and it is a rotten job trying to move him as they are frozen stiff to the ground. Recrossing the road higher up, we see a dead German, quite a youngster, sprawled out on the debris of a smashed and collapsed house. The attitude looked a bit suspicious, for we could see no apparent wound, and so we tied a rope to his feet and heaved him along a bit. Nothing happening, we conclude no bombs on this one, so we examine him. I find the cause of his death, for on turning him over, the whole of the back of his head has been blown away, and his brains have come out, more or less intact, a terrible but fascinating sight. I feel very sick. It could not help looking at him. Quite a youngster, barely in his 20s. His forehead and temples seemed to have caved in, yet his expression was one of perfect peace, as if he were asleep. We carried him up to the pit diggers, and he was one of the first to go in. At the dressing station, I find them terribly busy, and it's quite obvious they won't have time to see me. The sights are terrible in the extreme for men, or what were once men are carried out of the dressing stations and sometimes even straight out of the ambulance and taken straight over to the pit for burial. And it seems a miracle that some of them could even have lived for as long as they have. The groans and shrieks from the operating theatre are sickening, yet no one seems to pay attention to it. Prisoners, wounded and otherwise, come down, these wounded going straight in for attention with our men. Back to dinner, then off in the opposite direction to bury more Germans and sticking their rifles and identity discs into the ground to mark their graves. We go over to the field ambulance again in late afternoon. Indescribable scenes, a continuous procession of stretchers from ambulances to operating theatre. Awful sights, like a terrible nightmare. Now, I do wonder as I read that whether it's a bit exaggerated there, because we know that men that died in casualty clearing stations or base hospitals or even at dressing stations weren't buried in a mass pit. They were given individual graves and their final resting places marked properly. Even the Germans that they'd also tried to treat. But it still gives us an idea of the horror of fighting on the Somme and other theatres of battle in the First World War. Now, I've also come across an account dated July 1916, so about the same time that this is all happening, and it's written by a man that was the Member of Parliament for Northampton, a man called Hastings Lee Smith, who was serving as a stretcher bearer on the Western Front. And he talks about a new invention, the steel helmet, sometimes referred to as the Brodie helmet. He says, "We've had steel helmets served out to us now, in common with all other troops up here. They are certainly a splendid protection against shrapnel and snipers, and many a life would have been saved if they'd known their value at first. But they are the most uncomfortable things to wear in the world. An iron pot, the shape of a pudding basin, is the last thing to carry about on your head during the hot weather. Some of the men have found other uses for them. If the leather is torn out of the inside, they are most handy for cooking eggs, frying a piece of beef or boiling tea. This use of them, however, is not likely to spread and is being officially discouraged by methods which I will not distress you with by describing." And he also talks about the local French civilians that they come across. He says the manner in which many of the civilian population cling to their houses in spite of every danger is one of the most striking and pitiful things out here. Right up to the firing line, in places so dangerous that the question arises whether soldiers should be billeted there, women and children are to be found, often with the houses round them blown away, but apparently determined not to leave their homes until they are smashed to bits over their heads. British soldiers on landing in France are greeted by French children with a series of cries which seem to be intended to imitate the bleating of a sheep. I remember wondering for a day or two after my arrival why every little boy or girl ran after me crying, "Beaky" or "Beaky Bee." I soon learned that they stood for biscuit and bully beef. The motto of the army rationing is, "When in doubt, serve out biscuits and bully." Both of these articles are thoroughly unpopular. The army biscuit is a species of large dog biscuit, so tough that to eat one is 10 minutes hard work. Bully beef is quite good in its way, but after I'd received five tins in 5 days, I grew tired of it for the duration of the war. The consequences is that the soldier is very generous in giving them away. On the journey up to the front, is lined with children at every village, crying out demands for these two rations. And one of the amusements for the journey is to watch them scrambling for whatever is thrown at them. I don't know about you, but I always find it fascinating to try and understand how the soldier felt when he received these new pieces of kit, what he felt about the rations that were issued to him. And in this case, it's fascinating to try and get an understanding of what the local civilian population was going through while the fighting raged on around them. I've told so many stories about the 1st of July over the last 4 years in this podcast. This is the first time I think we've talked about a successful advance on the 1st of July 1916. And I feel so proud to know that so many of those men that carried out that successful attack that day came from my hometown. They stayed in those trenches on the 2nd of July, but on the following day, there was another 7 men killed and 30 wounded. And on the 3rd of July, they were relieved from the trenches. And they went back into bivouacs, tents near Bromfay Farm, where they'd moved up from. And the following day saw the Commander-in-Chief, Haig, issue the following statement, which was a message from King George V. He said, "Please convey to the army under your command my sincere congratulations in the results obtained in the recent fighting. I'm proud of my troops. None could have fought better or more bravely." Their commanding officer, George Ripley, was to lose his life just a few weeks later during the Battle for Teepvow in September. But he was absolutely delighted with the performance of his Northampton boys that day. And the local Northampton newspaper contains a tribute, it says, to his splendid lads. This is what it says. "A thrill of pride will be conveyed to everyone interested in the brave Northamptons on reading the following stirring description on how the 6th Northamptonshires have again distinguished themselves in a way worthy of the highest traditions of our splendid line battalions." The popular commanding officer, Colonel Ripley, to whom it must be a source of intense satisfaction that he had recovered sufficiently from his recent wounds to take part in this memorable push, writing on the 5th of July, says, "I shall not be disclosing military secrets as I write to let you know that the regiment I have the honour to command went through their first big battle on July the 1st. The division to which we belong were the first, I believe, to accomplish the task allocated to them, and the following complimentary messages were received from our generals. I, of course, omit names and anything else that could possibly be used by the enemy. The first message comes from the GOC of the 18th Division. He says, 'Well done, is what I expected. Now hold on to what you've gained so splendidly.' The second message was from the Corps Commander. 'Please convey to all ranks my intense appreciation of their splendid fighting, which has attained all asked of them and resulted in heavy losses to the enemy. Nearly 1,000 prisoners have already passed through the cage.' And the third message came from the Army Commander. He says, 'Please convey to the 18th Division my best congratulations and thanks for their dashing attack yesterday. They've done excellent work and I desire to thank them most heartily.'" Now, Ripley went on to say, "Personally, I'm more than proud of my men. They advanced through a heavy barrage of artillery fire as steadily as if on parade and straight to their allotted objectives, where they worked like Trojans amidst a heavy bombardment. Our losses, considering what they came through, were not heavy. I'm grieved that I cannot possibly write to all relations to those who've fallen on the field of honour. As it is, I have to use a Bosch telegraph form to write to you. But I ask them to accept this as assurance of my deep sympathy. Their dear ones have died like heroes and not in vain. I believe 2 other county regiments are fighting somewhere near us, and I trust Providence has been equally good to them. My only regret is that I'm not 20 years younger. I'm too old to command such splendid lads. I am too old to command such splendid lads and feel quite ashamed to have to be helped over obstacles that others take in their stride. However, I could not be helped along better if I were their father. And like many other broken-winded old hunter, I still hope to be in at the finish." One of those young lads that George was so proud of was Private 14006 Richard Jerrams, who was born in 1895 and was working as a bricklayer, living in the high street of Middleton Cheney, a village on the very edge of Northamptonshire. And in September of 1914, having seen the appeal for volunteers, he and his mate Joe Bayliss walked about 25 miles from their village, Middleton Cheney, to Northampton. They slept under a hedge on the journey there and back. Why did they do that? Because they wanted to enlist in the 6th Battalion of the Northamptonshires. And that's what they did, enlisting on the 5th of September 1914. Richard was one of those that was wounded that day. He was taken to a casualty clearing station where he succumbed to his wounds. 3 days later, he was 21 years old. Obviously, back home in Middleton Cheney, he was greatly missed. His family sat down and penned a short poem about their boy. And it said this: "We often think of the days gone by when we were all together. A shadow over our life is cast, our dear boy gone forever. He sleeps not in his native land, but under foreign skies, far from those who loved him best. In a hero's grave he lies, sadly missed by his father, mother, brothers and sisters." His mate Joe, who he'd walked all the way to Northampton with, was no doubt with him on that day when he was wounded. He was to live but another 2 weeks. He was killed in action in the fighting for Trones Wood. He has no known grave and is remembered on the Teatvale Memorial. He was 22 years old. One of the officers that we talked about here was Oliver Schreiner, and he was actually from South Africa. He was born in Cape Town in 1890, and he came to the UK to read law at Cambridge University. And he had a brilliant academic career, winning all sorts of prizes. But when war broke out, he applied for a commission and ended up, of course, with the 6th Battalion of the Northamptonshires on the Somme on the first day of July. He comes to it unscathed, but is wounded in the right arm at Trones Wood a couple of weeks later. For his bravery on the 1st of July, was awarded the Military Cross. After recovering from his injuries, he didn't go back to the Western Front. He was sent instead to Mesopotamia, what we now call Iraq. He survived his ship being torpedoed on the way. He was then demobilised after he'd attained the rank of captain. And then he completed his legal studies and he was called to the English Bar in London. And then he went back to South Africa in 1920 and set up practice in Johannesburg. Now, this was a very difficult period for South African history. And such was his ability, historians say that he should have been appointed as the Chief Justice, the highest position in South African law. But he was passed over twice for this appointment. And it was said this was because of his political beliefs. He was described as the greatest Chief Justice that South Africa never had. And it was because he was described as a liberal. He opposed racism and in particular what became known as apartheid. And even in his old age, he refused to sit on seats on the bus that had been allocated to white people only. Oliver died on the 27th of July 1980 at the age of 90 years old. Another officer that was wounded that day, sadly, didn't live as long as Oliver. He was Captain Frank Septimus Neville, who was born in 1891 in Dunchurch, near Rugby. Just before war broke out, he passed his civil service examination, and that enabled him to become a member of the Officer Training Corps, the OTC, and he was transferred to the 6th North Ants in 1914 and was severely wounded during the successful attack on the 1st of July. And whilst he was recuperating, he took command of a cadet corps. But having been transferred, having been evacuated from the trenches, it must have been awful when he discovered that his brother, Captain George Neville, serving with the Somerset Light Infantry, had been killed in action on the same day that he was wounded. And George Neville is now buried in the Sayre Road No. 2 Cemetery. Frank returned to the battlefields in August 1917 and finds himself caught up in the Battle of Passchendaele. He was wounded towards the end of that battle with a bullet in the abdomen, and sadly died of his wounds at a casualty clearing station on the 24th of November 1917 and is buried in the Dozingham Military Cemetery near Poppering. So we got two officers there, both wounded in the fighting on the 1st of July. One lived to be 90 years old, and one returned to battle and died just over a year later. From their assembly trenches that morning to where they ended up, 6th Battalion of the Northamptonshires covered approximately 2,000 yards that day, and together with the other battalions of the 18th Division, their success in moving so far forward was beyond comparison to the disaster that struck the BEF in other parts of the battlefield, in particular on the northern side of the Albert to Bapaume Road. We often talk about the slaughter and the horror and the futile fighting that went on and the dreadful loss of nearly 60,000 casualties that day. But I think on this day, 110 years ago, after those men advanced up the hill towards Pommiers Redoubt, that it's important that we note, discuss and celebrate what was a tremendous success on the battlefields of the Somme. As I said at the beginning of this episode, the Northamptonshires were in reserve that day, supporting the 7th Battalion of the Bedfordshires and the 11th Royal Fusiliers, and also in support was the 12th Battalion of the Middlesex. It's important that we note them. The first waves of troops from the Bedfords and the Royal Fusiliers reached a trench called Emden Trench, which was in front of Pommiers Trench, within 20 minutes of going over the top at 7:30. There was some uncut wire, and that held them up for a while. But when they reached the enemy's dugouts, they found the Germans only too willing to surrender. By the time the advance had finished, the division, 18th Division, was nearly 1,000 yards beyond the redoubt. So, as I said earlier, about 2,000 yards from where they began. And ahead of them, they could see the dark mass of Mametz Wood, which was to be attacked by the Welsh. In his book, A Subaltern on the Somme, veteran Max Plowman describes in a letter home what he'd discovered when he went in to what remained of Pommiers Redoubt at the beginning of August, so about a month after the attack. He said that we are entertaining ourselves in what rather more than a month ago was a German redoubt. As far as my company is concerned, it consists of about 150 holes in the ground, none more than 3 or 4 deep. In fact, there are glorified shell holes with a light roof of wood and sandbags over them without any covering, and in one of them I slept very comfortably last night with another officer, and I'm now sitting in the step of it as I write. The history of the 5th Division gives us a clue as to the origin of the name of Pommiers Redoubt. It says, owing to the prominence of a group of apple trees midway along this ridge between Montauban and Mametz, it was known as Pommiers Ridge. For weeks, the trees were used by the British artillery for registration purposes until it became a daily habit. One night, the Germans felled and removed the trees, and the ensuing consternation of the forward observation officers, the Foos, the following morning was most entertaining to those not directly concerned. The following week, as the Welsh prepared for their attack on Mametz Wood, one of their officers came up to the redoubt and provided a report on what was left. He said, scattered equipment lying about underfoot, tangles of wire, small dumps of forgotten stores, all left behind in the advance. Other things were left behind in the advance, part of the purchase price of this downland. Grim, disfigured corpses rotting in the sun, so horrible in their discolour that it called for an act of faith to believe that these were once men, young men, sent to their death by fellow men. If you go to the battlefield now, you'll find the bodies of those boys from Northamptonshire that died that day. In amongst 2,053 burials and commemorations of the First World War, in the Danzig Alley British Cemetery, built on top of a German trench. But those lads, that wasn't where they were first buried. They were taken back into the British lines after the front line had moved forward and buried, most of them, in a small cemetery called Montauban Road Cemetery in Carnoy, in the village itself. And some of them were buried in a nearby cemetery called Vernon Street Cemetery. But after the war, those two cemeteries, along with several others, were closed down, the bodies exhumed and reburied in Danzig Alley Cemetery. And now when you stand at the front where the entrance gate is to Danzig Alley Cemetery and look down the hill, you can see the ground that the Northamptonshire lads and the others in the 18th Division advanced up on that day. And then when you look to the left, just across the road that runs towards Montauban, you can see just a slight rise in the ground. And that's the exact position where the Pommier Redoubt was based. And that's the exact position where that private soldier threw his two hand grenades into the German dugout and forced the surrender of the terrified defenders that were there. That's about all there is to see now. No signs of the trenches, no signs of the three small mines that were blown beneath the German lines just before zero hour. All that is long gone. But the spirits of those lads that fought there, that may still be there, who lie in Danzig Alley, they'll be there forevermore into eternity. And I do encourage you, if you go to the Somme, please do visit this cemetery. For no other reason, it gives you a great view of the southern part of the battlefield from the 1st of July. At the back of the cemetery, you can look at the ground that was fought over in the few weeks that followed the 1st of July. The horseshoe of woods. And there are so many fascinating stories and so many emotional, personal inscriptions on the headstones of the boys that lie in Danzig Alley that one day I'm going to tell more of the stories for that particular location. But that is for another day. For now, we remember those that died in the taking of Pommier's Trench and Pommier's Redoubt on the 1st of July 1916 by the sounding of the last post. Mm-hmm.